Okay, my name is Darren Gross. I'm a controller at Indianapolis Tower and Approach, and I've been with the FAA for 30 years. I just recently retired at the beginning of the year, the end of January.
And how long have you worked at Indianapolis Tower? Is that your only facility?
No, I began my career in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at a small VFR tower, and I was there for about 3 years, and then I moved on to Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was a combined up-down tower with a guard base. 20 years ago, in 2002, I moved to back to Indianapolis. I'm from here and started at Indy Tower, which is also an up-down approach tower. In 2015, I moved over to the center, to Indianapolis Center, and I was there for a little over 2 years, and then I transferred back to the tower in 2018, and then I finished out my career there and, like I said, retired earlier this year.
And what made you want to be an air traffic controller?
I became a controller because my dad, I'm actually second generation. My dad worked for the FAA in the early 70s, and he was a PATCO controller. So I've been around aviation my entire life. I always grew up with, you know, my dad working at the airport and hearing stories about him having to go to the airport. He took a hiatus in 1981, courtesy of Ronald Reagan's union busting show. And anyway, he got rehired a few years later than that. When I got out of high school, I went to school at Indiana State, and there was a program back then in the late 80s and early 90s called a co-op program. So since he was already a controller, he said, you should look into this co-op program. They'll be there. When I was a freshman, I was 18. He said, they'll be down there giving a test. You should just go show up and take the test and see what happens. So myself and I think there were three other students. Then the FAA came, we took the aptitude test, and they gave us the results back. And a couple months later, they said, yeah, you qualified. If you want to join this program, you'll have to go through the same initial steps that everybody else does: security, background check, and psychological and drug tests, and all the, you know, fill out all the paperwork and all that. So about a year later, they notified me, said, yeah, you can start the program. You'll have to take off school because it starts in January. So I was 19. And the second semester of my sophomore year, I started at Indy Center as a co-op student. And that particular program allowed the students to work in all aspects of air traffic. At the time, there were flight service stations, and you had towers, and you had approach controls, and you had the center. So I started at Indy Center and worked for about 6 months, took off, went back to school for a year, took off the summer, and went to the next option, which was a flight service station in Terre Haute, Indiana. Did that for 3 months over that summer. Went back to school, and the last module is what they called them, was at Indy Tower and Approach. Did that, and then went back to school and got my degree in the winter, in December. And then I started full-time with the FAA at the center as a strip ripper in A-side, they used to call them back then. I was certified in one of the areas as an air traffic assistant. And I was just at that point waiting on the FAA to assign me my first facility, which they did. I started in Ann Arbor 9 months later in October after I got out of the academy. Okay, a few years ago, they started the Lift Academy here, which is for Republic Airlines. Republic Airlines are based here in Indianapolis. So they started this Lift Academy with DA-40 and DA-42 Diamonds and Twin Diamond aircraft. For those of you who don't know about Indianapolis or aren't familiar with it, we're right behind Memphis for FedEx's cargo operations. Memphis is the largest cargo operation. So you can imagine with the type of aircraft that FedEx has, heavy 767s, Airbuses, 777s, DC-10s, MD-11s, and then these little single engine trainers with students in them. And they put these two operations right beside each other here at the airport. So it's a challenging day when you come into work traffic here because of the volume that the Lift Academy has grown to. They take off in waves. There'll be 8, 10, 12, sometimes 15 of them will take off all different directions to go out and practice. And then they're gone. And then they all come back in waves. The Indy Airport is under a major reconstruction phase right now. They've torn up one of the main parallels and they're totally stripped the runway down. They're replacing the runway. And it's a 3-year project. It's costing hundreds of millions of dollars. So airport capacity is down, which makes it even more challenging. But it was fun, you know, before I retired, dealing with a lot of student pilots with Lift Academy.
So your experience with student pilots, what is the take from the controller side? Like maybe as far as being patient, explaining things, do you ever talk slower to them or do you have any, what's your experience working with a student pilot?
Well, Jennifer, that's a good question. I got the benefit of starting my career in Ann Arbor where there were also multiple flight schools. The University of Michigan had their flight school. There were some other small ones, and there was a helicopter flight school. So I got the benefit of learning the job of an air traffic controller along with the student pilots at the same time. So we both had to take time and listen to each other because I know the instructors knew that I was a new controller and didn't quite know how to speak on the radio or how the phraseology worked. So, you know, this was over 27 years ago when I started that. So I got to learn early on in my career to take a little more time with the students. They're learning the radio. They're learning the procedures. They're learning the aircraft itself. And I think that carried through my entire career when dealing with low time pilots or student pilots. You can just, a lot of times you can hear in their voice a hesitancy sometimes they want a question, you know, say again, or what was that? So I just always had that tune in my ear to take a little more time with them. So I think in this particular situation, when this happened, and this pilot was calm because he checked on approach, good morning, and then I just lost my engine. So I don't know whether that was just his lack of understanding about how dire the situation was, or he really knew what was going on. He was just, you know, cool as a cucumber. Just my dealing with these students on a daily basis with this call sign, I just knew to be calm with them. They need that reassuring voice sometimes.
Okay, so now we're going to go in and talk a little bit more about the event. 1 year later, you got to walk into the Flight Academy today, actually, and everyone remembered the event. And what was their reaction when you went in and asked, hey, do you remember this event with a student pilot who lost an engine a year ago? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was reviewing the radar replay and listening to the audio tape of this event. And I had to listen a few times because, like I said, it was garbled and I couldn't quite understand what he said. But the pilot checked on, he said, I've had a dual ECU failure and I've lost my engine. So I just came in and spoke to one of their instructors and we talked about what the ECU is and what it does. And he explained it's an engine control unit and it's a redundant system. So there's an A and a B, and sometimes one will fail. And it's just like in your car when the check engine light comes on, it's telling you that something is wrong with the engine or the control unit. It might be a false setting, but there is a redundant system. And he explained there are two of them. There's an A and a B, and they can both go out and the engine can run. You just don't know what's going on. But in this situation, both ECUs went out, dual failure, and the engine quit. So in speaking to one of the other flight instructors, he remembered the incident and said that on that particular aircraft, the fuel pump had stopped. So it stopped the engine. The engine was getting no fuel, that the gears and the fuel pump had totally disintegrated. So there was no restarting of that engine. Usually you explain when the ECUs fail, you can reset everything or replace the fuses and get it to come back on and it'll start operating. But in this case, after the aircraft landed, they towed it in and they broke down everything. The fuel pump was destroyed. The gears in it were gone. So that aircraft was a glider at that point. He wasn't getting to get the engine to restart.
So in situations like this, you obviously understood the severity of the situation when an aircraft calls up. So when this pilot called up, he said, I lost an engine. Is that what he said?
Yeah, he said, I've had a dual ECU failure and I lost my engine.
And at that time, either one of you probably really understand the actual severity of the situation, correct? Compared to what you found out today with all of that?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, when I hear I've lost my engine, I just think back to other incidents in my career where I've been working airborne aircraft that have lost their engine and they had nowhere to land. I was training a girl one time and they actually ended up ditching in a field. So that incident was in the back of my mind. And in his location, they had just departed toward the southwest and they were going to Lansing, Michigan. They returned to the northwest. They were over a highly populated area. And there's, you know, you see these videos every now and then of aircraft landing on the highways and landing, you know, in traffic and dodging vehicles on the highway when they land. Where he was, there's nothing. You're talking of neighborhoods and commercial highway 40 that goes across the entire United States is just north of this airport. There's no way that guy's landing on that road with all the air, you know, with all the traffic without a bad ending. So at that point, I'm looking at either he's going to do a turnaround and come back in and land the runway that he took off of, which wasn't going to happen because there was a departure had just come out behind him. He could go back around and land on the runway that he took off of, but there was an arriving aircraft. The Phenom was out there 8 or 10 miles, and I don't think he had enough altitude to make that anyway. So the only other option, there's a crosswind runway. All he had to do was make a 180-degree turn and come back in, and it just required the coordination of myself and the tower controller and the ground controller to make sure the runway was clear, and then rolling the, I mean, that was an emergency at that point. So the tower had already picked up the crash phone and rolled the trucks, and on this particular airport, they have a 90-second rule. They need to be out of their firehouses and on location within a minute and a half. That's one of their rules here. So this whole incident, after I looked at the recording, it was truncated too. They cut out a little section of it, so I don't know exactly how long. It was less than a few minutes. So I assume that the crash, fire, and rescue were out there waiting on them when they came in on the crosswind.
So you would say in this situation, the pilot was actually pretty lucky to be able to make that 180 and land on a parallel runway? Would you say?
No, it was a crosswind. He departed toward the southwest, and then there's a crosswind that goes, he actually landed to the southeast. So he took off southwest and was turning toward Lansing, Michigan. He turned on the reciprocal of the runway he landed. He was on a 320 heading, and he turned 180 degrees around and came back in and landed 14. So yeah, they were in the perfect position, and he had just enough altitude, and they had climbed to almost 3,000 feet. When he checked on, I saw he was at 2,900 feet, and this field elevation here is almost 800. So they were 2,100 feet above the ground. I'm not real familiar with the glide ratio on this aircraft. I do know when you turn without power, you're going to lose altitude. So he just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right aircraft around him. There were, like I said, a couple other departures that had headed the other direction, and the arrival was far enough out. And luckily, when we use that crosswind runway all the time, like I said previously, the one of the runways was closed. The parallel runway was closed for construction, so that wasn't an option just because of equipment and things being on it. So it was just one of those perfect timing that he was able to turn the aircraft around and come back in on the crosswind runway.
Was there any thoughts or point in your mind that you thought this was the last transmission? These were the last words you were going to hear of this pilot?
No, I didn't think that aircraft was going to crash, to be honest. I thought it was going to be a successful landing and there wasn't going to be an incident. And maybe it was because of how he checked on, approached, good morning. Hey, this happened. I have no engine. It's just the attitude in his voice. I didn't hear that fear. And I've heard that in pilots' voices before. Years ago, I had a young lady that was caught above an overcast, and she wasn't IFR rated, and it was thunderstorms and it was turbulent. And I could hear the terror in her voice, the please help me. And we figured all that out and got her sorted out and through a hole and back down. And that's a different sound. They don't have any control, and she needed to calm down. This particular pilot, I didn't sense anything in his voice. He was right there with me. He just said, yeah, I think I can do that. I said, can you make a right turn, come back in 14? Yeah, I can do that. So we were both on the same page and the same team. We're gonna work on this together, and we're gonna get you right back in and get you on the ground safe, and then figure out what happened.
I like what you said about being on the same page, and like when you're in tune and you know that you're helping, the importance of you being calm and giving them that extra assurance that like, we got this together, you know, like I'm in your ear, you're in my ear, and we're both going to make sure you're on the ground. I do like that, you know, because I've been in situations too where, man, that pilot is legit panicking. You don't know if that is your last transmission. So, and it is, it's a whole different voice, and you feel it vibrate through your body too, right? Like,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, well, I've seen crashes. I mean, throughout my career, hell, the University of Michigan Lifeline helicopter crashed right in front of me. They had a total tail rotor failure, and they had to auto-rotate and crash right in front of me. Luckily, nobody died. It didn't totally destroy the aircraft, but that happened when I was at Ann Arbor, and with all those student pilots when I was at Michigan, they used to ground loop all the time. They'd land and get all squirrely, and next thing you know, they're off the side of the runway and running into stuff and tore up the plane. And I was at Fort Wayne and worked a guy that landed gear up. He was in a twin, I think it was a Baron, at night, and cleared the guy to land, and next thing you know, I saw a bunch of sparks. Like, what is that? The supervisor grabbed the crash phone. He said, that guy just landed. That's the props on the runway. So, I mean, I didn't see that because it was dark. Same airport, I saw a Skyhawk Cessna, you know, single engine Cessna, took off, got in the air, and then nosed in and crashed on the north side of the airport. All I saw was a big puff of, it was dirt. It wasn't smoke, it was dirt. But he called back and said, I'm okay, I'm upside down. He had landed and the aircraft was almost upside down on the top of the aircraft. He was on a fence. That guy survived that too. So, I mean, I've seen crashes and heard a difference in those pilots' voices ended up being crashes. But in this case,
are you a pilot?
No, as part of my school down in Indiana State, I had to take ground school and some practicum classes. So I've gone through ground school and I've flown a few hours, but the degree I ended up with is called Aerospace Administration. So freshman and sophomore year, we started off with the pilots and then they went off on their course and started to fly, where we went off on our track, which was more business oriented, management, administrative stuff, law, things like that. So after and I was working with the FAA at the same time. So I didn't, other than going through ground school, but I probably know enough about small aircraft and flaps and settings and speeds and things. And I could probably, if I had to, 30 years later, I could probably fly an aircraft, but I don't know enough to get me in trouble, probably.
What advice do you have for student pilots?
I would say my advice to a student pilot is, because of the intimidation factor, a lot of them are intimidated because it's the approach control or the tower, and they don't, some controllers don't have that great of an attitude when they're dealing with low time pilots and students. And I would say, do not hesitate to ask a question or to say again, I'm sorry, I'm student, I didn't understand that. A long time ago at a facility, we used to put in the identifier as a Q, third line or fourth line. I don't recall what was on the data blocks, but we'd put a Q in there for squirrel. It meant they were squirrely. The Q was the designator. When you handed somebody off, you know, they knew, hey, take care with this one. Something's wrong. They either are low time. And
now that you are retired, how are you filling up your days?
To be honest, I mean, after you do something for 30 years, and especially this job, it becomes your identity. It's who you are. You know, it's in the fabric of yourself as a person. So I'm actually kind of struggling because I'm no longer an air traffic controller, at least for now. So and my purpose was to go to work every day and keep people from dying, basically get everybody from point A to point B safely. To be honest, you know, they prepare you prior to retirement. Most of the preparation that you do is financial, to make sure that you got all this, you know, you're going to make enough money to make it the next 25, 30, 40, 50 years, however long you live. It's a financial preparation, but they don't prepare you for that loss of your identity and your loss of purpose. It's not been an easy transition for me right now. I haven't really been looking for another job as far as a contractor job to go back into work with training. I worked with several controllers that are back over at the tower now, and they work in the training department. Other guys have gone on as contractors for other places. They work in contract towers, smaller places in the state. I haven't really pursued that. I don't know what I'm going to do. Whether I want to go back into something aviation related or not. I've been traveling extensively. When I started prior to retiring last year, one of my daughters and I traveled the country. We drove all over the place. I think in the past year and a half, I've been to over 20 states. I've been almost half the country. I've been out of the country, I don't know how many times, two U.S. territories, about 7 or 8 foreign countries. I'm leaving in a few days and going down to Mexico. So right now I'm just traveling and doing some things that I didn't get a chance to do while I was employed by the FAA. When the winter comes and I don't have a lot to do outside, I'll probably start looking for something to do to keep me busy, or I'll just run out of money because I traveled all the place.
That's wonderful. What advice do you have to the generation behind you, the controllers in training right now?
So when I retired, they are working on a system here at Indianapolis that would automate the flight progress strips in the tower. Take the little pieces of paper that we use that has all the information on it, and everything would go to automated. So they were working on putting the big screens in and the entire reconfiguration of the tower and putting that system in. I think it's TDFS, Terminal TFDS, Terminal Flight Data System. not sure what it's called, but so as everything does with progression, everything becomes more automated. So I would tell this newer generation to don't lose that human element. Don't rely on that automation so much that you think it's going to save you. And luckily I came from the generation where we still had to, when the radars failed, we still had to go into SYNRAP and backup radars and things. And these kids now have no idea how to do any of that. I mean, these star systems have quadruple redundancy. So there's a backup of a backup of a backup. So hopefully nothing like that happens. But back in the day, 30, 40 years ago, when the radar failed, you had to rely on your knowledge and the rules and the .65. So unfortunately, I don't think a lot of that stuff is taught to the newer generation, and they rely heavily on automation. But at some point, you're going to have to fall back on that training and what's in that book. So my advice would be don't get reliant on the automation. Remember that you're the human element, and those people on that other end of the frequency, those pilots, they're going to need your help, not some computer to tell you what to do.
I love that. I am always trying to get our trainees to go to air shows or career days in flight school so they can remember, that's a voice in your ear, but that is a human.
In my younger days, we always had a very large air show here just to the east of Indianapolis called the Mount Comfort Air Show. And it was big. They always brought in the Thunderbirds or the Blue Angels. And I always volunteered to work those shows because they put you on the roof of a building and it broke it down to the basics of air traffic control. You had a piece of paper and a pencil and a radio, and that's all you had. And you had a few procedures. You had a letter of agreement that you had to work off of, but that was just the basics. You had aircraft call you from whatever position they were in, whatever direction they were from the airport. You wrote the call sign down and you told them what leg of the pattern to enter, and same thing on the ground. Hey, tower, this is, November, whatever, I'm on the ground. I want to do this. So you gave them direction to the runway. And I know Oshkosh just happened, and I never did attend Oshkosh. I let the guys, younger guys who wanted to go to that, always attend Oshkosh. But in those places, it breaks it down to the basic. I mean, really all you need is at a towered airport is a radio to talk to them and a way to remember who you're talking to. So I always enjoyed that when the air shows came along and they needed someone to have they gave us a temporary control tower operator certificate to work at these airports. Unfortunately, I did work one time in Greenwood, which is just south of Indianapolis. There was a fly-in event. We had a temporary control tower there, and there was a helicopter crash. It was giving student pilots, or they were giving rides to potential students, and it was a small Robinson helicopter, which they're dangerous anyway, but tried to take off and tipped it a little too far and caught the rotor, and next thing you know, there were parts. We heard a loud noise from the scaffold we were on. They gave us a scaffold that day. We heard a loud noise and looked over, and there were parts flying around everywhere, and we thought, well, that's the end of the air show, and notified FISDO and notified all the chain of command we had to. And unfortunately, that day ended quickly. But
do you want to tell me about the importance of teamwork with your fellow controllers?
On that particular day, that incident that happened, and I know we all have people we work with that we know how they handle stressful situations, and you can rely on them. And there are other people who maybe aren't so reliable when it's a non-standard operation. But when I heard him call and say, hey, I've lost my engine, I immediately hit the landline to the tower. And that particular controller, I'd work with him. He was a new guy. He'd been around a couple years, but he came out of the Air Force, and there was a, after I reviewed the logs and saw who else was up there, there were two younger guys who both came out of the Air Force and a lot of training. So I knew as soon as I heard his voice and I heard him yell over to the ground controller, hey, stop everybody on 1-4. I knew those guys knew exactly what was going on. There wasn't going to be any issues as far as the teamwork aspect. There could have been a few people that I would have heard their voice and thought, uh-oh, this might be a situation. They might not know how to handle this and they might lock up. But in that particular instance, I knew that pilot was in good hands with all of us.
I love that last part because teamwork is so important, and be able to, just like you said, like, okay, I'm okay handing them off to the next person, right, in this situation.
Yeah, well, in that case, they always tell you got an aircraft in distress or having an emergency, don't ever switch their frequency. So, I'm sure when the FAA heard that tape, I didn't follow procedures. I'm supposed to do a bunch of stuff, flash and do all this other stuff. And I kept him. I just told him, hey, I'm going to keep him. but this guy's struggling to keep his plane out in the air that doesn't have an engine. I'm not going to tell him to switch frequencies, you know, go over to the tower frequency. So I'm sure there might have been some questions about that, giving him a landing clearance from the departure sector down in the TRACON. But at that point, I'm trying to get the guy on the ground as quickly as possible and without him crashing. So, you know, I did what I did. There's sections in the 0.65 that tells you just to make it up. You know, if you don't know what to do, use your best judgment. So in that instance, I mean, the best thing to do is get the guy turned around to a long piece of flat concrete and put the aircraft on the ground.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, I've worked in airplane where same, I had to give them a clear to land from a radar spot, and you are relying on that tower to say, is there anything else that... I mean, you have an extensive background, which is very nice, a ton of experience that makes a lot of that difference. And just knowing, I can't stress how important it is to know that there's a human on the other end of that earpiece or that dash on your scope. So last question, what does receiving this award mean to you, especially after retirement?
That's kind of a tough question. I mean, receiving an award for something that you're trained to do on a daily basis. I mean, it's great. I'm honored, but you've gone through the same training I have. And the rest of us, the rest of the controllers out there have. The mundane radar contact, you know, clear for takeoff, climb and maintain, clear direct, that stuff, you know, anybody can do that. We're all trained to be there when incidents like this happen. Pilot is in distress and they need an assistant. That's really when we make our money and are there for, like I said earlier, those people, those voices on the other end of that frequency, the other end of that mic. So, I mean, receiving an award for something that was my job anyway, that I'm supposed to do, like I said, it's great. It's an honor. But on the flip side, that pilot is part of the situation too. So he should be honored too for listening and cooperating and basically saving his own life. I mean, relying on the training that he received, along with my training, you get in a situation like this, you're on the same team. You want to have the same outcome. And you want to put it in a sports analogy, you got to win. You don't want it to end in a negative outcome, to end like in this situation. This did. And I'm sure all these other people that won, I haven't reviewed any of the other incidents, a couple of them. One of them was, well, that was last year. A guy had hypoxia. I've heard several of these RGs that people have hypoxia. You could tell right away. Tell right away somebody else. Yeah, I mean, like I said, that's a hard thing to answer. It's an honor, but it's a shared honor, like I said, with the controllers in the tower and the pilot himself.
Okay, wonderful.